This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. State officials are concerned about lower than projected income tax revenue, but there's more disturbing news about the next couple of years.
The state will have 200,000 fewer jobs than it had over a decade ago.
Treating gun violence like a health problem and gunshot victims like victims of that problem.
I don't care what happened. Right now, if you're not in custody, my job is to help you understand what is actually going to happen from this point forward.
Then we talked to a couple who've been given the job of painting a Detroit artist's work on an 11-story building.
You try to be as true to the artist's intention as possible. It's humbling. It's cool.
We'll also talk to the artist. And a Detroit cocktail became the number one cocktail in the nation in the 1950s, a key ingredient, Campbell's beef broth.
It's not nearly as bad as I thought it might be.
But first, let's find out what's happening in the rest of the world. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The state of Michigan got a sort of good news, bad news scenario this week. Projections show income tax revenue over the next couple of years will likely be less than expected, about $300 million less for the state's general fund. But the sales tax-based school aid fund is projected to bring in more, about $340 million more. Here to discuss what the state might do are Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants, and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken, revenues are still going up, but just not as much as expected. What do you think the legislature will do with this news?
Well, the revenue picture really hasn't changed that much, so I don't think it has a big impact on the current budget. I think the more disturbing issue coming out of the revenue estimating conference is that even a year from now, the projection is that the state will have 200,000 fewer jobs than it had over a decade ago. And from a long-term standpoint, an economic standpoint and revenue standpoint, that's alarming.
Vicki, it's been suggested the legislature might take some of the school aid fund money and give some of it to public universities and community colleges, which would then free up some money in the general fund. What do you think about that possible shifting of money traditionally meant for K through 12 schools?
Well, Governor Snyder's been shifting money from the school aid fund to colleges and universities and community colleges since he took office. So this is not new. It's something that many of us who supported putting money into a school aid fund and leaving it for school aid K through 12 have been very disturbed about. So that's not something that's unusual for the governor and the Republican-led legislature when they go to budget. The real question, as Ken was alluding to down the road, is the Senate Fiscal Agency projects that by 2023, we will have a $2 billion deficit in the state general fund and budget that we're going to have to figure out how to fill. So long-term projections, and I don't think going out to 2023 is all that far long-term, is very scary. The promises that we made to have personal property tax repealed for businesses has not been offset by enough revenue coming into the state. And there's a $600 million annual promise by the legislature to use that money to fix roads. So there's a lot on the table that has been promised and very little money coming in to fulfill those promises.
Ken, there's been this heated battle between legislative Republicans and the governor over switching teachers, new teachers, from pensions to a 401k style plan. Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News is reporting now they're completely at an impasse, that the Republican leaders in the Michigan House and Senate abruptly halted budget talks with Governor Rick Snyder completely. Ken, are we going to have money to do that? I mean, that's going to take a big buyout, right?
That's true, because if you close a retirement or a pension system, and it doesn't matter whether it's in the public or the private sector, there are short-term and long-term costs to that, and you have to pay that. There's some upfront costs that could be substantial because you don't have people then paying into the system, and yet you still have people collecting a pension. Now, I will say that personally, I think they have to get to a defined contribution or 401k system for teachers. I don't think it's fair or even politically viable to have sort of one group of workers, in this case teachers, having a pension or defined benefit system, and then virtually everybody else, whether public or private workers, have a 401k system. I just don't think going forward you can do that. But the problem right now, if you're going to do that, there's upfront cost to it.
Vicki, what's your take on pensions versus 401k style retirement plans?
I'm a former financial advisor, so this whole discussion is very troubling to me. I disagree with Ken in terms that you can't have public school teachers on a defined benefit plan and not anybody else. We have state police on a defined benefit plan. We have judges on a defined benefit plan. And defined benefit plan is a pension. It's based on the number of hours you worked and your salary, and there's a number that calculates it. The whole problem here is they're blaming the fact that they keep removing school district employees by privatization, charter schools, and a whole bunch of other means out of the teacher's plan and into private plans without accounting for that loss. So it's exacerbated the problems in MPSRS, which is the Michigan Public School Retirement System. Now, they do need to fix that somehow, some way, and if they choose to close it, that's fine, but they're going to have to come up with several billion dollars over the next few years to close that plan. We already talked about the fact that the budget projections are not looking all that rosy between now and 2025. So I don't know where they're going to find the money to do that. So the real conflict here is there's still this desire on the part of some legislative Republicans to guarantee that there's a tax cut, and yet there is no money for the tax cut. So the governor, the Senate leaders, and the House leaders are all on three different pages here, and they're going to have to somehow work it out.
Let's change topics here. Ken, for a very long time, the state of Michigan felt a special responsibility for protecting the Great Lakes. It's routinely passed tougher state environmental laws than the federal government. And because this was once a very strong union state, it also passed tougher worker safety rules. Some Republicans want to end that, making state laws being stronger than federal laws a rarity. What do you think of that proposal?
Well, this effort that you're referring to is really a complete reversal of what Republicans have been saying for years about the state-federal relationship. The Republican platform historically has been that the state should be in charge of law and regulation and set the markers, not the federal government. But now, out of the Michigan House, Republicans are saying, well, we should defer to the federal government, and we should assume that federal regulation versus state regulation is right. And as I said, that's just a complete reversal of what Republicans have been saying for years about who should be in charge.
Vicky, Speaker of the House Tom Leonard says this puts decisions in the hands of elected federal officials instead of bureaucrats. But those state bureaucrats are trained biologists, engineers, and other experts. Elected officials often don't have that expertise, at least not at that level. What's your reaction to that view?
Well, I'm just thinking, is the Great Lakes state, 95% of our watershed is the Great Lakes. President Trump recently rolled back rules to allow coal ash to go into streams and rivers. I'm just thinking of the devastation that could occur to 20% of the world's fresh water. So I think that Speaker Leonard is completely wrong on this one. And the governor does, too. This is not a Democratic or Republican issue when you look at protecting our environment. This has been a bipartisan issue for many, many years. On the negative side, this would be a very, very damaging bill going forward for workers, for the environment, and a whole host of other groups, which is why even the League of Women Voters put in a card saying that they do not support this. On the other side, let's look at the bright side. In 2011, a similar bill that was passed in the Senate and the House was vetoed by Governor Snyder. And I'm not one to always sing the governor's praises, but he was right on that one. Last year, a similar bill passed the House and died in the Senate. So just because this bill sailed through the House, and it didn't really sail through it, it passed basically 57-50. It's going to go to the Senate now, and it's in the Senate hands, and they, I'm hoping, don't take it up just like they did last year.
That's Vicky Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. And we heard from Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislator. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lester.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings. And this might be the weirdest set of ingredients you've set up for a mixed drink I have ever seen.
That's true. And it is also the most popular drink ever to come out of Detroit.
Really? Well, what's it called?
It is called the Bull Shot.
And who made it in Detroit?
So this was invented in 1952 at the Caucus Club, and that famous Detroit restaurant and bar has just reopened in the Penobscot building, its original location. And so that seemed like a good reason to finally dust off this drink that we've been holding in our back pocket for a while.
Are they serving this drink, the Bull Shot, now?
They are, but they've updated the recipe some. The drink we're going to make today is the original.
Now, you said it was the most popular drink. I've never heard of it, so how popular was it?
So by the late 1950s, it was the most popular drink in America. It was known as a freak drink, right? It was something that was really supposed to freak a bartender out, maybe challenge them. So celebrities loved it. This was a way that they could really establish themselves. And we haven't said anything about the ingredients yet. So we start off with 1.5 ounces of vodka. That's pretty regular. And then things take a strange turn because the next ingredient is 2.5 ounces of Campbell's beef broth.
And it has to be Campbell's beef broth.
The original recipe calls for it because the owner of the bar was friends with an advertising exec who had an account with Campbell's. So there was a little bit of co-marketing going on, shall we say.
What else is in it?
So this is basically like a Bloody Mary, but with the beef broth standing in for tomato juice. So we've got a couple dashes of Worcestershire sauce, a couple dashes of Tabasco sauce, and the juice from a wedge of lemon.
Tell me how to make it.
So mix all those ingredients up in a shaker, strain it into a fresh glass with fresh ice, and then grind some freshly grated black pepper on top.
This could really be good, or this could just be terrible, and I'm not sure, really, based on the ingredients, which way it's going to go. So,
me neither.
Have you had it before?
No.
Try it.
I want you to taste it before I say anything.
Okay, you don't want to bias me. You know, it really is kind of like a Bloody Mary.
It's not nearly as bad as I thought it might be.
In fact, you know, I kind of like it. I can see why it was so popular.
It's not too sweet, which is, of course, a problem that we have with some drinks today. It's definitely very unusual. It's cold.
This is good, but the one thing I kind of want is some celery salt in this.
Well, since this is just like a Bloody Mary, you can treat it like one and make it your own. So just like we add all sorts of crazy things to Bloody Marys, go ahead, put some celery salt in or some horseradish.
Okay, well, that's the Bull Shot from the Caucus Club.
Right, and if you want to check out an updated version of that, you can now do that back in Detroit. Cheers!
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Crime is down in Detroit, but the homicide rate in the city is still high. For all the talk about Chicago's murder rate, Detroit's per capita rate is higher. There's an effort to deal with that directly. DLive is going to hospitals and talking to gunshot victims. DLive, which stands for Detroit Life is Valuable Every Day, is based out of Detroit Medical Center's Sinai Grace Hospital. It's a violence intervention initiative, and here to talk about that is Calvin Evans, a violence intervention specialist with DLive. Why do you visit the gunshot victims? What's the goal here?
It's not just gunshot victims. It's anyone who's a victim of violent trauma. So that being gunshot victims, stabbings, and blunt trauma as well. And the goal in that is it's the teachable moment. Reach them where it is that they are to prevent and stop the recidivism of individuals coming to the hospital as a victim of violence.
Now, they're in the hospital. They're hurt. And some guy comes up to them that they don't know. How receptive are they to you?
For the most part, they look at us as if we're the police. And so after we overcome that barrier and we're there for the particular purpose and help them to understand that we're there for the particular purpose of helping them get through the healing process, the pain that the trauma has caused.
The emotional pain as well as the physical pain.
Emotional and physical, yes.
You mentioned that some of them think you're the police. Detroit Public Television's One Detroit Initiative did a short video about DLive. Here's a clip of a guy named Travis Causey, someone you talked to just after he was shot.
I met Calvin because when he came to my bedside right after the police did. So I'm thinking he the police. I'm like, man, go on here with that, man. You the police, man.
You approached Travis after the police interrogated him for a while. How difficult is it to earn the trust of some of these victims?
Generally, it's not really that difficult because I come from the background, so I understand the language, understand the condition. So after the whole thinking that you're the police phase, it's like, okay, why are you here? And by and large, for the most part, within the community, what you'll find is individuals know that individuals like myself do exist to try to stop young individuals from getting in trouble. So they automatically begin to identify with that.
Now, you have some insight more than most about violence on the streets. Tell us how your life experience is used to deal with the people that you're trying to help.
Actually, I did 24 years in prison. I was a drug dealer. I was shot. I was stabbed. So I draw back on that experience, those experiences, if you will, to kind of like say, what is it that I needed and what is it that I didn't get that would have prevented me from being just like they were, you know, that put this to a stop, that put this to a halt. What is it that I needed? And so I think in those terms and I operate from out of that function with those individuals.
So how do you help them? I mean, what do you do?
At first, I look at them as if they're a victim. Trauma-informed care. That's the first approach. We're not going in looking at it as if you're the perpetrator. I don't care what happened. Right now, if you're not in custody, my job is to help you understand what is actually going to happen from this point forward and how to mitigate those things.
Everyone's different. Probably get different responses, different reactions to you reaching out to them. How do the responses vary for the people you're trying to help?
By and large, for the most part, most people respond favorably because there's these stigmas that exist in the hospital that if you go into the hospital that you're going to die, that the hospital isn't necessarily there to help you. So they're trying to cling on to someone who they feel is going to provide them with some sort of assistance, if you will.
You look at violence as if it were any kind of health problem, which is usually viewed, you know, as a crime problem. How well do the doctors and the police and the other folks you run into and have to work with understand what you're doing, the perspective from which you come?
So that's a part of the job also, being able to inform everyone that have contact with these individuals. It's called trauma-informed care. What it is that these individuals are experiencing and how to deal with that. So we look at it from a framework called asset framing. And asset framing is we look at what's right with you as opposed to what's wrong with you. Deficit framing does that. And so we don't deficit frame. We asset frame and we try to utilize that language of everyone who's having contact with that individual.
In that video we talked about, Travis Causey, later in the little video, you had him out. You put a camera in his hands. You brought a professional photographer along. Is that the kind of thing you do to help them discover talents or job skills that they just haven't had a chance to develop?
Yes, we try to figure out what it is that they like most and then connect them with the resources around that particular area, that particular thought. Travis liked cameras. It's obvious as a parent. And so I connected with several individuals that were involved with photography. And from there, you know, his passion continued to grow and they began to mentor him as well. So now we're building a network or a web of individuals around this individual's hidden gifts or his hidden talents.
Yeah, he's got some good instincts. He's got an eye for it, it looks like. Here's the big question. How do you measure whether DLive is working, making a difference?
So Wayne State University actually does the research on us. And as of April 8th, we have become eligible to be a part of the National Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs. And our numbers actually shattered the numbers across the country within our first year. But our barometer of measuring is that they say that once you become a victim of violence, that up to 45% of those individuals return within a 2 to 5 year period, mostly within a 2 year period. So we're doing a retrospective study on that particular that study that happened over a course of 5 years. But also, to this point, no one has returned to the hospital as a victim of violence that has signed up for DLive.
Wow. It's a pretty good record so far.
So, you know, what is the Tylenol for violence? And I believe we've discovered it. It's a collaborative effort, you know, of many different individuals and many different organizations and the individuals themselves to buy in. And so all that begins basically with our just showing them that we love them, that we care for them, that we're here to assist them in any way that we possibly can. And the assisting them is doing the right thing. How do we assist you to do the right thing? What does it take? And so as you saw with Travis, it was the camera, you know. Someone else's culinary arts, you know, someone else's pre-carpentry. So we try to find those things and just put everything around that those things and to help that individual.
Kelvin Evans is a violence intervention specialist with DLive based out of Detroit Medical Center's Sinai Grace Hospital in Northwest Detroit. Thanks for telling us about DLive.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Our ongoing Am I Curious series gives you, our listeners, a chance to ask a question, and we do our best to get an answer. This time, the question comes from Daniel Mormon from Superior Township near Ann Arbor. Daniel, what's your question?
Well, my question is, how is it possible any copper mining could take place in the Porcupine Mountains? It's supposed to be a wilderness area.
I think a lot of people have been wondering that. The Porcupine Mountains Wilderness State Park is a 59,000-acre area in the Upper Peninsula. It's on the west side of the UP, taking up an area between the Wisconsin border and Lake Superior. Here to hopefully answer Daniel Mormon's question is Nick Schreck. He's director of the Transnational Environmental Law Clinic at Wayne State University Law School. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
So how is it possible to do copper mining in the Porcupine Mountains Park?
Well, it's possible, but will be difficult. And the first thing that we need to understand is how, in Michigan, surface rights, so the rights to use the surface land, like in the Porcupine Mountains Wilderness State Park, and subsurface rights or mineral rights. And in Michigan, you can sever surface rights from subsurface rights. And so what happened is the Porcupine State Park, when it was created in 1945, the park then bought additional land in 1948. And that additional land that was purchased in 1948, the state was only able to acquire the surface rights in that land and not the mineral rights or the subsurface rights. And so what's happening right now is that this company, Highland Copper, they're actually drilling exploratory well holes to look and see whether or not there is sufficient copper in the area where they hold these subsurface rights to determine whether or not they would seek to mine that copper. But an important thing to point out, even if they do find that there's sufficient copper for them to invest in trying to extract those mineral resources, they would have to enter underground by tunnels under the surface of the Porcupine State Park to get at those minerals.
So they couldn't build the mine on the surface of the parkland?
Correct. There will be no surface disturbance allowed, and they would have to, you know, tunnel underneath, under the ground, to extract their minerals.
The Porcupine Mountains Park is a wilderness state park, so what special protections do wilderness areas get?
There is no allowable mining or mineral extraction within the wilderness area of Porcupine Mountain State Park.
And I know exploratory drilling is also not supposed to be allowed in designated wilderness areas. So the DNR says no mining will take place from the surface anywhere in the park, but there is this exploratory drilling. Despite its name, not all of Porcupine Mountains Wilderness State Park is technically a state-designated wilderness area. Highland Copper is exploring another part of the park. So not all of the park is protected by the Michigan Natural Resources and Environmental Protection Act, which prohibits exploration for or extraction of minerals. Now let's talk about the park as a whole. Nick, they couldn't actually put the mine on the surface, as we mentioned, but during this exploratory part, the mining company has been on the ground drilling.
But again, the company does have a right to access these minerals, these subsurface minerals, in these exploratory wells. This was a permit granted by the DNR for this, you know, limited number of exploratory wells. The problem is the state was not able to purchase those subsurface rights, and so legally, the company has a right to access those minerals without doing any surface disturbance. And so the question becomes, how could they potentially access those minerals without disturbing the surface of the park? And in order to make that determination, the company would need to get a separate permit from our Department of Environmental Quality, where they would have to ensure that they would not in any way damage the surface or any of the resources on the surface of the park. And that would be a separate permitting process where there would be an availability of public comment.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Department of Environmental Quality permits for exploration, because they were granted. But last month, the DEQ noted in a letter to the company that it wouldn't have issued permits considering how the mining company has gone about it. The DEQ indicates the company took no efforts to avoid damaging wetlands. Photos of the exploratory mining areas this spring show a muddy mess. There were citations, but if the DEQ says it wouldn't have granted permits for this kind of work being done, why can't the DEQ suspend or revoke the permits?
There's a really important distinction to be made here, and that is that the DNR actually allowed this limited test drilling operation within the park. The DEQ, they would be issuing a permit if there was actual mining to take place. So what happened was, when these exploratory wells were being drilled, the company unfortunately did not follow appropriate stormwater controls and construction site management controls, and they allowed a lot of mud and silt and dirt to wash into wetland areas and created a whole mess, primarily because they were doing drilling after the ground had thawed. Now, within the park itself, no even exploratory drilling is permitted after the thaw, when the ground has thawed. And so where all of that muddy mess occurred, that happened along this county road that runs through the park. And the DEQ has said that that activity is inappropriate. They did not have the right, you know, site management, stormwater management in place, and that they allowed all sorts of mud and debris to get into wetland areas and into streams in that area of the park. So that is very problematic, as you point out, and it does raise extreme concerns as to whether or not this company would be able to actually do mineral extraction, again, below the surface, so they'd have to enter from outside the park and tunnel under the park, whether they could do that in a way that is safe and protective of this really precious natural resource that we have here in the Porcupine Mountain State Park.
If they find enough minerals that it's worth their money to retrieve them, will there have to be another permitting process?
Absolutely. So our Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, would have a permitting process that would look at how this company would propose to extract minerals underground. So they'd have to tunnel in under the park and extract any of the copper, and they would have to ensure that they would not damage any of the surface of the park. So any water, any rivers, any of the trees, any of the vegetation, any cultural resources, anything that could potentially be damaged on the surface, the company would have to ensure and make a demonstration to our DEQ that they would not impact anything on the surface and any of the water quality or any of the forest resources, et cetera, that we have within that park. That would be a permitting process that would include the opportunity for public comment, and so people would be able to voice their opinions for or against whether or not this activity should be permitted. But that, again, would only occur if this company requests a permit to actually do the mining, the copper mining of these minerals underneath the park.
While there's concern about damage to the parkland, the surface of the parkland, the mining operation could employ 300 people or more in an area where jobs are really scarce. What economic pressures are there in a situation like this?
Well, that is a consideration. And of course, looking at economic factors are something that really should be a part of the discussion, but they are not determinative. And what I mean by that is just because a particular project creates some jobs or might promote some economic development, that does not mean that we set aside the requirements within our Department of Environmental Quality permitting process to ensure that the parkland is not damaged. And it also doesn't mean that we make any sort of concessions as far as the requirements that the company would have to face in order to get a permit. So while that is a factor to consider, and it's something that certainly would be part of the political debate, whether it be in Lansing or up there closer to the park, that's not something that is determinative for the permitting process.
Let's turn back to the person who asked our Am I Curious question. Daniel Moorman, did we get your question answered?
Well, in a technical sort of a way, I guess. I mean, I guess I understand the difference between surface rights and mineral rights. I don't know whether the mining company could come and mine my backyard or not. I honestly don't know who owns the mineral rights here. One of the things that you haven't mentioned, though, either of you, is the fact that not only is this in the Porcupine Mountains, this is within a mile or so of Lake Superior and two rivers.
Exactly.
And copper is extremely poisonous to fish.
Nick?
That's absolutely correct. There's a great concern with water quality here. And so, again, if this company, and if they're actually going to put a proposal in to do this mining, they would have to demonstrate that they will not allow impacts to the rivers that run through this proposed project area, as well as to Lake Superior. And so that would be, again, part of the permitting process for this company would go through with the DEQ. And I would encourage the public to, you know, if this permitting request does get filed, to please reach out to both our DEQ and the DNR, be part of that public commenting process, and ensure that questions about water quality, questions about impacts to the park, that all of those are appropriately vetted, and that DEQ understands the, you know, really significant public concern that we have with mining either adjacent to or underneath this Porcupine Mountain State Park.
Thanks to Nick Schreck. He's the director of the Transnational Environmental Law Clinic at Wayne State University. And, of course, thank you, Daniel Moorman, for your question.
Sure, thanks.
You know, one of the things we're still not sure about is whether the company, Highland Copper, could explore the designated wilderness area or not. It's protected, but if the company owns the mineral rights, the whole thing could end up in court. By the way, we asked the company, and they would not reveal if it owned mineral rights under the wilderness area, and the DNR said they didn't know. Well, then another Am I Curious voting round open right now. Go to michiganradio.org and find the Am I Curious box to vote for the question you think we should look at next. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The last Packard automobile rolled off the assembly line in Detroit on June 25th, 1956. After that, the plant was used in various ways, but for years now, the sprawling automobile plant, about 3.5 million square feet, has sat empty and deteriorating. 3 years ago, Spanish-born developer Ferdinand Palazuelo, currently of Peru, offered hope for a future for the Packard plant, and after that, we didn't hear much. Well, this week, Palazuelo was back in Detroit to announce the first phase of development of the Packard plant. Joining us now is Carrie Smith. She's director of development of Arte Express. That's Palazuelo's development company. So first, remind us of the kind of development Palazuelo has completed in other parts of the world.
Fernando's company, Arte Express, started almost 40 years ago, converting buildings in Barcelona and Madrid, Spain, starting with historic buildings that were converted into art gallery spaces. Since then, there's been 126 historic buildings converted worldwide, and those are in places like Barcelona, Madrid, Palma, Mallorca, which is an island off of Spain, and most recently in Lima, Peru, where he's working on the renovation of 23 buildings in the central core of Lima.
So what kind of investment are you making at the Packard plant? How much money?
For the total of the Packard plant, we're looking at approximately $500 million. And the first phase for the hard cost is slated for $16 million, and that's the former administrative offices of Packard Motor Car Company, located at 1580 East Grand Boulevard in Detroit.
So what does the first phase include? How many buildings? There are like 43 buildings on the site.
Yes, this is one building. It's 121,000 square feet, four stories, and it fronts on East Grand Boulevard. Originally, it was the administrative offices of Packard Motor Car Company, and it will be converted back into office commercial space.
I understand you have some tenants committed. What kind of businesses will call the Packard plant home?
We have a variety of businesses ranging from architectural firms, environmental companies. We have a testing engineer company, a Detroit Training Center, which trains adult Detroiters who have had a checkered work history or problems with the law in the past, concentrating on building arts and construction trades and putting them into the workforce here on the Packard and in other developments in Detroit.
I was at the abandoned Packard plant yesterday. It's a huge footprint, and much of it is in pretty bad shape. After this development is opened up, you're still going to be surrounded by a lot of blight, and a lot of that blight you own. So what's going to be done between now and phase two of the project?
Well, we have four phases actually lined up. The second phase will be running consecutively with phase one, and that is a large restaurant tenant that will be moving into a standalone building on the site, which also fronts on the boulevard, the large patio space and parking area. Our phase three is a recreational build out, also located on the boulevard. So that really takes care of the fronting buildings on East Grand, and then we'll continue on to a residential building, which will be our phase four.
You're going to have some residential property there. There's a high rate of percentage of poverty in Detroit. Is there going to be affordable housing included in the development?
Yes, it will be a mixed income artist live workspace will be our first residential component. But we do have several buildings on the north side that we plan on creating residential components into.
Final question. Are there any plans to have some sort of tribute to the Packard cars, the workers, the history of the place?
Absolutely. We are planning a museum. We're finding the best location that we can on site, but we've had a lot of coordination between the Packard Motor Car Clubs and different architectural and archaeological collectors that will be included in that Packard Museum.
When's phase one finished?
Phase one, we're looking at early 2019 for occupancy.
That's Carrie Smith. She's director of development of Arte Express, which has broken ground on the first phase of redevelopment of the long-abandoned Packard automobile plant in Detroit. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
The online publication Jalopnik has released an investigative report which looks at whether the Detroit Police Department back in the 1990s used false statements from jailhouse snitches to close murder cases. Ryan Felton is the reporter, and he joins us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. This lengthy story has a number of twists and turns, so let's just try to break it down. First, who was Bernard Howard?
Howard was a 18-year-old resident, native of the city at the time. And basically he, you know, as he would put it, was just someone who was, you know, wrong place, wrong time, more or less. He was a friend of someone who was killed in a triple homicide one night in July 1994, and by way of having a similar nickname as someone who was said to possibly be involved, that sort of is what led him into Detroit Police Headquarters and eventually down the path that led him behind bars today.
Right, charged with multiple homicide. Now, here's the twist. He did sign a confession. What were the circumstances?
Mm-hmm. He met with an officer who basically came in after 8 hours of being questioned by a couple of her colleagues. And the officer basically said, as Howard would put it and as she put it on the stand, basically they both agree that he signed a statement. But as Howard would put it, it was coerced out of him. As he put it, she said, just sign this statement and you'll be able to go. You'll be free to go. And he just basically after 8-9 hours of being questioned said, I didn't think anything of it at that point because I just wanted to get out of there. And the weird twist with this is that officer actually later sued the city, claiming she was put in a position where the homicide division routinely did this with suspects. And that was sort of one of the weird quirks of this case, is that, you know, it wasn't so cut and dry that it was just a blanket statement from a jailhouse informant that put this person away. It was also this other aspect of Detroit police that's unseemly and, you know, very familiar to people, I think, who know what the department was like and known for at the time.
Now, it seems odd, I think, to most folks that anybody would sign a confession to something they didn't do. But David Moran at the Michigan Innocence Clinic tells me false confessions are a lot more frequent than you'd think because defendants buckle under the pressure of ongoing interrogations. They just want it to end.
Yeah, the recent stat is, you know, 1 out of every 4 cases that have been overturned through DNA evidence, it's found to be that they were put behind bars because of a false confession. So, I mean, it happens way more than people may ever actually realize.
So Howard ends up in jail and ends up talking to some guy named Joe Twilley. Who was he?
Joe Twilley was a guy who was sentenced to second-degree murder in the late 80s, and he was being held at the time at Detroit Police Headquarters downtown because he was a witness in a separate case. As Twilley himself put it, he routinely was a guy who worked as a trustee at the jail, which allowed him to basically have a few extra amenities than typical inmates would have. But that put him in a position where if he's passing out mail, other inmates would just start opening up to him, which to many defense attorneys at the time would seem inexplicable, because why would someone just randomly open up to someone else that they've never met and say, yeah, I did this crime? And Twilley said on the stand in Howard's case, actually, that he overheard 40 to 50 confessions in his 7-8 months that he stayed at Detroit Police Headquarters, which is an extraordinary amount.
Well, clearly people wanted to talk to him and confess themselves to him. So Twilley gets some extra perks in jail. He gets to walk around a lot more. He's a trustee. He gets a TV in his jail. And he also got his sentence reduced. All this was arranged, at least in part, by a guy named Detective Bill Rice. Who was he?
Bill Rice is someone whose name comes up time and again. He was a well-known homicide detective in the 90s. If you read newspaper accounts, even, you know, the national papers talking about homicides in the 90s, Rice's name comes up when it comes to Detroit because he was a very established police officer. He's come up lately as a link to the Devontae Sanford case, which is very fresh in the minds, I think, of people in Detroit, given that Sanford was recently released from prison. Rice himself ended up in jail for committing perjury as it relates to that case. And he also came up in the Rick Warshy case, better known as White Boy Rick. Rice signed an affidavit saying that he basically was put up to lie at the Warshy's 2003 parole hearing, you know, said he came and testified that Warshy was a threat to society, but he never actually even knew, you know, the extent of his case. So Rice has a very interesting history as it relates to things that have happened in the city of Detroit.
Let's set the stage. In 1994, there were 541 homicides in Detroit, mm-hmm. twice the murder rate than New York City. You write that City Hall dictated that police needed to close cases at all costs. How did they respond?
It's been explained to me, you know, that's why you would see some of the sort of habits that began that led to the Justice Department intervening eventually in the late 90s and the early 2000s by, you know, doing things like widespread arrests. Like if, you know, taking in any single person for any reason that was at the scene of a shooting, these dragnet type arrests, that was something that happened in the 90s that the Justice Department later reprimanded the city for. I mean, so you saw a lot of things happening around this time that government later came in and clamped down on the police department for doing because it violated individuals' rights and for so many different reasons. So, I mean, you definitely saw it manifest itself in the way that the Detroit police kind of conducted itself at the time.
Weren't prosecutors a little leery of relying on one jailhouse informant for maybe 40 or 50 different cases?
Well, that's sort of the open-ended question here, right? I mean, there's documents and memos from the prosecutor's office at the time where they're raising concerns about the use of these informants that basically they've been told by defense attorneys at the time that these guys are being told that they'll receive leniency in return for their assistance. And the one thing that I still have not been able to sort of get at is why was this sort of left on the table, because the memos from the prosecutors who were in the know on this, it's very explicit concerning language that, you know, we're at risk of over these cases being overturned if we're not told of these police deals, which there's very concrete proof that they weren't told about these deals that some of these individuals received.
So Bernard Howard signed a confession. There was this testimony from Joe Twilley about a confession in jail. Was there any physical evidence in his trial?
No. That's another sort of striking element of this whole case is that there are several individuals who were at the scene, but no one ever actually points and says, you know, Bernard Howard was there. I know he was there, other than one of the other shooters who says that his statement was also coerced. There's so many instances where you have people who claim that they are wrongfully convicted, but this just has sort of all of the elements tied into one with the added caveat that there's this informant that was linked to so many cases at the time.
So Howard's still in jail, right?
Yes.
As this information has come to light, has any of this been revealed to the courts? Has he had any hearings or does he have any options?
He basically has been filing his appeals on his own and recently had a federal judge hand down an opinion that denied him a new hearing, basically in saying that the thrust of it was he showed that Twilley basically didn't have evidence at the time that could have impeached Twilley as a witness, but he still signed this statement that appears to be a questionable admission. So he still nonetheless denied him the hearing, despite, you know, the evidence otherwise.
Bottom line, what do the Detroit police and the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office have to say about what you've uncovered?
The police department, number one, didn't say anything because it was just so – the cases are so old. The prosecutor's office basically said that, you know, their policy is to review informant testimony and, you know, has always been the case. And it was more so generalized and nothing too much beyond that.
So other than this investigative report you've done, Howard's in the same place he was from the beginning.
Yep. That's basically the case, yeah.
Ryan Felton writes for Jalopnik. His story is titled The Would-Be Auto Worker Caught Up in a Detroit Prison Snitch Scandal. Ryan, thanks very much.
Thanks for everything.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I went to visit one of Detroit's icons, Charles McGee.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay, coming in.
We're going in here?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's designed a mural called Unity, which is being painted on a new redevelopment by Bedrock. That's one of Dan Gilbert's companies. The 28 Grand building is at 28 West Grand River Avenue. Unity will cover the north side, 11 stories. It's a black and white design that McGee's fans will recognize as his. I asked the 92-year-old artist what goes into one of his pieces.
Well, the work comes out of, I guess you say, a philosophical kind of underpinnings of togetherness. I believe that nature put us all here with something that's kind of unique to each individual.
Tell me about unity. When were you first inspired to do that?
When they asked me to.
Oh, it was a commissioned work.
Yes. It was a commissioned piece. And I, having worked these 92 years making art, I felt like this was the basic theme in what I wanted to talk about, you know.
You have pieces in a lot of prestigious museums and all over the place. What does it mean for you to have something like this, a mural on the side of a building?
In a few words, it's hallelujah time.
It's a big statement.
Yes, it is. And I feel blessed to have the opportunity to do it. And I feel great about being able to, over these years, come to the point to where I'm able to do it. It's all been a learning process, and it continues to be. And I think that is the food that feeds me through my daily activities.
You can see a copy of the design on our website, michiganradio.org. I went downtown to meet the people who are actually scaling up the design to building size and painting it.
Jordan Zelke, with my partner Kelly Golden, and we're a Golden Sign Company.
The two partners are familiar with McGee's work. They saw him speak at a Penny Stamps event in Ann Arbor about 7 years ago. They feel it's an honor to do this job.
Being able to actually meet him and talk to him, and I mean, we haven't had a whole lot of time to sit down because we've been so busy, but I'm looking forward to the gallery opening that's on the first, where they're going to have his retrospective right across the street, and just a very
you'll be done by then.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's the hope. Yeah, we're gonna crank next week and get it all banged out.
When you're doing something that's this complicated and this scale, what are the biggest challenges?
I would say the phase we're in right now is the biggest challenge. Actually, transferring the artwork up onto the wall, it's pretty tedious, but it's a foolproof method, and yeah, it's just time consuming and we're grinding it out.
Most of the work you guys do is commercial work,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So this is real art. How does that make you guys feel?
It's exciting. It's like you said, it's different, and you try to be as true to the artist's intention and as true to their stroke as possible. It's humbling. It's cool.
That's Jordan Zilke and Kelly Gordon talking about executing an 11-story mural designed by Charles McGee. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock, who stayed awake the whole hour today. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Nick Wallace, and Lise Mesmer, who we say goodbye to today. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.